Just in and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. 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 Jay, how healthy is Sean Stevenson? That guy's like the healthiest guy I've ever met.
I know, he's so buff. Every time I look at his Instagram story, he has so much energy and then he's in the gym almost every day. I don't think I can do it.
I can't believe the story he just told us. He was like, so, and this is for everybody, he was diagnosed with this degenerative spine disease when he was 22. He was, I don't know, 100 pounds overweight, something like that. They told him it was incurable. He got depressed when he heard that. And we talk in this podcast, we talk all about the placebo effect, the nocebo effect. I couldn't believe what he was saying, the statistics about placebos. I didn't really know that. I mean, I knew roughly, but I didn't know to the extent he was just describing to us. He does the Model Health podcast, so I highly encourage people to listen to his podcast. But he also wrote a book called Eat Smarter. When I first met him, he had just written the book Sleep Smarter. But this is my favorite. It's the Eat Smarter Family Cookbook. These recipes are delicious. He talks about the science. He talks about the cultural aspects. Look, if you get nothing from this podcast at all, try the Supreme Salmon Burgers. Get the Eat Smarter Family Cookbook. But Sean's got great stories, and the goal was he's trying to help me figure out. I mean, I was convincing myself that I was an old man, and he kind of set me straight on a bunch of things. And, well, you'll hear. Here's Sean Stevenson.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Sean, like you were last on the podcast in 2017. We also went to watch Dave Chappelle and Radio City Music Hall together. That was great. That was a lot of fun.
Iconic moment.
Yeah, Chris Rock performed. Arsenio Hall performed that night. It was great.
The guy who does the roast, wasn't he there too?
Oh yeah, Jeff Ross. And then one other guy, I forget who it was. I forget, but it was such a great show. And you know, we haven't even like really kept in touch that much. I then got so into it. I went on to do stand-up comedy and I bought part of a comedy club for a while. And now only in the past few years, I stopped doing it. Like, but I was like doing it six nights a week.
That's the thing about you. You will do it. When you do a thing, you're going to do it. That's crazy amazing. Wow. Holy moly.
And here's where I need help now. And this is why I was thinking of you. And it was so great too that you've written this cookbook, Eat Smarter. By the way, the breakfast sandwich, the Supreme Salmon Burgers, there's a couple of chicken dishes. These are so good, these dishes. Like, I know it's all about health, but it's important to taste good too, or else I'll just stop it. And these dishes are incredible. But we'll get into that. But here's why I was thinking about you, and here's where food is needed. Like, so I'm 55 right now, and I'm feeling it. Like, I'm losing memory. I'm losing my ability to think fast, and I'll describe how I know this. I'm able to actually measure it in this weird way that my listeners probably are aware of what I'm talking about, but I'll explain to you. And my stamina has gone down. And again, I've been able to actually measure this. So after a 25-year break, I've decided to return to my youthful love of competitive tournament chess. So 25 years ago, I was a good high-ranking chess master in the US. And when I started playing again after a 25-year break, and this was just like a year or so ago, I immediately fell. And I know I fell because my memory is having a hard time, my ability to calculate fast is having a hard time, and I run out of steam by the end of a day on a tournament. And that's made basically what's called a one standard deviation difference, maybe a little bit more in my ability, meaning people who I used to be even with, I'll now lose 2 out of 3 times. And it's really painful. And I'm writing a book about the process. I've talked to neuroscientists and sports psychologists and on. And I'm, of course, I'm being like coached in chess by very strong players. But something's wrong that has nothing to do with my ability. It's all these health related and age related things. Like, the brain changes, the body changes. I never thought I was old, but I see now I'm different than when I was 25 years old.
I just saw yesterday a man performing. He's 70 on stage. This vitality, his ability to pull forth ideas, his ability to have kind of the ability to pivot and to change and adjust things on the fly was remarkable. And I'm just like, that is the potential for all of us. And many people, and I just, even yesterday, same thing. A little bit earlier, somebody was telling me about these senior moments that they were experiencing. They're like in their 30s. And they're just like, you know, man, I walk into a room. I can't remember why I came in here. It doesn't matter what age we're at. We can all experience these moments. But there are some consistencies that we see in the data and anecdotal stuff, like I just mentioned, seeing that guy on stage yesterday, that are really pointed to there are very specific ingredients to having a high level of cognitive function as we get older. All right, so that decline doesn't have to be as sharp, or in some instances, be there at all. Literally, you know, I just had a conversation with one of my friends at Harvard, Dr. William Lee.
Were you just name dropping there? Did you just Harvard drop?
I mean, you know, I know these are my guys. You know,
Harvard. Okay,
but that's it's the cognitive thing. Like, they're smart guys, you know. But he was sharing with me how, you know, really looking at human DNA. We've got so many innovations that have been able to, you know, like looking at our telomeres, which is one of our essentially a biomarker of aging, or how well we age has to do with our telomeres and how they get shortened as time goes on. It's basically like lighting a fuse, and eventually, you know, you get to the dynamite and it blows up, you know, like that's the end of that cell's potential. And he was sharing with me that looking at the data, our metabolic health, once we reach the age of 30, really doesn't go down. If we're living in the quote natural life, you know, looking at hunter gatherers, really doesn't even go down very much until you reach about 70 or 80. All right. So we see this phenomenon in our culture where it's just like onset of weight gain, onset of, you know, quote metabolism slowing down. But according to the data and really studying human genes and DNA, we're not supposed to have that much degradation between that. And again, you see certain people, they are fitting into that box where they still have a high level of performance, high level metabolic health. You know, for me, I'm in my mid 40s, but it's crazy. But for me, it's just normal what I'm able to do. You know, I'm out here pushing the sled a few hundred pounds down my cul-de-sac.
Yeah, but you're like, you know, in perfect shape. You eat, you just wrote a cookbook for eating healthy. So you should be, that's why I'm coming to you. You're the standard.
But, and I come from a condition, at 20, I was diagnosed with an advanced aging disease in my spine. You know, my physician told me I had the spine of an 80-year-old man. All right. So when I'm saying what I'm doing now, box jumping 50 plus inches, you know, running a sub 1100 meter sprint. These things were not only, I'm not supposed to be doing that. It wasn't supposed to be possible for me. Wow. Because I was told, you're not going to be able to walk normally again. You're going to be on medication for the rest of your life to manage this pain. You're just going to have a high level of dysfunction. So I was 20. I was a very old man inside of a young man's outer, not even my outer exterior, by the way. I look pretty old externally as well. But this is what's possible.
What did you do when you heard that news?
Oh man, I went into a spiral of depression. You know, getting a diagnosis. I just went in because I was having like a nuisance of a pain. Like my leg was, just didn't seem like my leg was loosening up. And that's sciatic nerve pain. But I didn't know it at the time. So I thought there was something wrong with my leg. And he had me get an MRI of my spine after doing a couple of tests. And I'm just like, why are you guys looking at my back? My leg hurts. Because I was so disconnected from how this thing works. And he put the MRI out for me to see. I had two severely degenerated discs, my L4, L5, S1. They looked black. You're supposed to be able to see light basically shining through those discs. They were black and they were both herniated. And so that was causing the pain. And so not only do I get this, you know, he puts it up for me to see, but he also tells me, because I ask him, okay, so what do we do to fix this? Right? He tells me the diagnosis, degenerative disc disease, and you have these two herniated discs. That's what the problem is. I'm like, okay, so how do we fix it? Let's go. And he's like, he literally like did his hands like this, like pumping the air, like, slow down, son. And these were his exact words when he looked at me. He said, this is unfortunately something that's incurable. And I'm sorry, son, but this is something you're going to have to learn to manage, and we're going to help you. We're going to get you, you know, some medication. We're going to potentially get you a back brace. We can look at you for surgery in a couple of years. But I'm sorry, son, this is, you know, this is incurable. And he said that incurable word a couple of times. And for whatever reason at that time, still my brain, I'm a very analytical thinker. And so I asked him, okay, does this have anything to do with what I'm eating, maybe like exercise, whatever? And I didn't really have any grounds to ask him those questions, but that's when he like kind of got a little bit frustrated with me, looked at me like I was from another planet, like, this has nothing to do with what you're eating. Those were his exact words. This is something that just happens. And I'm sorry that it happened to you, son, but again, we're going to help you to manage this.
And wow, so, he just totally gave up on you instantly.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I'm a research scientist. I've been in this field for 21 years now, but that is abandoning basic laws of physics. You know, like we live in a universe of causality. Maybe it's different in another, you know, pocket dimension or something where causality doesn't exist. But here, there's cause and effect. Things don't just happen. Like, to say that is negligent in and of itself.
So, but I could see, though, being a patient and believing this, like he said, it was degenerative. So maybe it was like always happening to you and since birth, and now you had just reached this tipping point, though, where the discs were essentially shattered from the disease, so you felt it.
Right, and that's what it would look like, because also when you get this diagnosis, for any of us, we tend to see the end result of the thing. That condition was years, if not over a decade in the making, because I was 20 when I got the diagnosis, and so that was happening for years and years and years in advance. But here's where everything changed, and by the way, one of the most important parts of this tale is the impact of the placebo and the nocebo effect, right? And the power of our minds. And this also is tying into where we're at with you and some of the things I've already seen that have been triggered. And we know in science today, it's very, very well understood. We don't know how it works completely, but the placebo effect is one of the most remarkable things in peer-reviewed data. We have to account for the placebo. We have randomized placebo-controlled trials, right? We have to account the placebo is going to get results in some people. On average, across the board in all peer-reviewed studies, the placebo, just the belief that a drug is going to create some therapeutic effect, it's a sham surgery, fake surgeries, the list goes on, that this is going to create a therapeutic effect is 33% effective on average. Somebody believing that they're getting the medication that's going to normalize their blood pressure, normalize their blood sugar, attack and degrade and destroy cancer cells, heal their ACL, the list goes on. We've got data on all this stuff now. It's about 33% effective on average.
That's amazing. So better than doing this podcast, I should have just asked you for a pill and you would have said, you could have said, take this pill, it's going to work. And I would have believed you and you could have just given me like a sugar pill and that would have at least had a 33% chance of improving my life.
The key, here's the key though, is how much you believe it. And you can placebo yourself. And I'll share a study with you to affirm this. So one researcher, this was at Stanford, Alia Crum and her team, they did this really interesting experiment where they basically did a skin prick test where they create like an allergic reaction where the skin would develop a rash. And then they had, they split the test subjects up and they gave one group an inert cream, a completely inert cream. It had no therapeutic effect, but they told them that this is going to make your rash get worse. All right. Then they gave another group the same inert cream and told them that this is going to make your rash better. All right. Same cream, no therapeutic effect in the cream whatsoever. But within 10 minutes, both groups' rash got worse or got better, depending on the input that they were giving. But here's the key. The magnitude of how much the rash went away or the rash got worse was dependent on how they thought about or perceived the person who told them. That authority figure, and this was the key word in the study, how competent they thought they were determined how much their rash changed. All right, so it's a trust in that authority figure. And that's what happened with me, but it's the reverse. It's called a nocebo effect, where I got a negative injunction that this bad thing is going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. And this happens to people every day. You have 3 months to live. You're never going to walk again. You know, whatever the case might, you're going to be on medication for the rest of your life. You're going to be in pain forever. That's called a nocebo effect. And it is just as powerful. And if you don't understand, like, this is one of the most important parts that is being explored in medicine today, thankfully, but it is not a common practice where our practitioners are being taught the power of their words, how powerful their words are when discussing treatment with their patients. Because again, just the belief, they can give them a sham pill, fake pill for their blood pressure, and about 33% of people are going to have a normalization of their blood pressure, at least temporarily, by the way. We're not talking about curing or treating. Some instances, it can be a more permanent. And last piece here, this goes into the cognitive piece. Some categories of medication are even more applicable or influenced by the placebo effect. In particular, things that have to do with the brain and mental health. All right, so on average, we see about an 80% effectiveness in placebos for reducing symptoms of things like depression. All right.
What if I know it's a placebo? Like, how do I convince myself that I see something that's a placebo? You said that even if I know it, there's potential.
Right. This is where the magic or the complication happens, because placeboing yourself is pretty tricky. And there's a great book out there. It's called You Are the Placebo. Dr. Joe Dispenza, and he's talking about some of this neurochemistry and the power of our beliefs. But here's the thing. This is where it's applicable for all of us, where we don't need a big buy-in. It's just understanding this one important takeaway from today, which is all of your thoughts create correlating chemistry in your body instantaneously. Your thoughts create chemistry in your body instantaneously. And so whether this is an affirmative thought, you know, something positive, you have a good thought, it's something, you know, that makes you happy or makes you feel gratitude, or you have an angry thought. Like, we feel that chemistry change, or an anxious thought. We feel that burning in our chest. You know, we feel that agitation. There's a change downstream with all of our neurotransmitters and hormones. And when I say that, that means every cell in your body is getting affected. There isn't a cell that's like off in your pinky toe that's just like, I'm not listening to everybody else. Like, all of your cells are in deep communication. That's what hormones and neurotransmitters are basically cell to cell transmission. And so if we understand that one big takeaway today, that our thoughts create correlating chemistry in our bodies, now we can start to choose the thoughts that we want to think. But that's where, again, it's a practice thing. It's just not easy. And here, last piece of this is, a powerful or empowering affirmative thought can actually be several times stronger than a habitual negative thought. Like my friend Daniel Amen, Dr. Daniel Amen, double board certified psychiatrist, largest database of SPECT imaging scans looking at the brain itself. He calls them ants, or automatic negative thoughts. And a lot of us, we're just replaying these things on automatic. And so we can kind of get in there and scratch up the record a little bit. But even more so, and here's the key, this is the last piece. When we're changing our chemistry and not doing this from external means, right, which drugs and all kinds of other treatments have their place, absolutely. But when you're creating that chemistry, you're making changes in what's happening with your norepinephrine or your cortisol or your thyroid hormone based on your thoughts. Those chemicals are made internally for you, for your receptor sites. So this isn't bioidentical treatment. This is literally made in you, for your receptor sites. And so the most powerful pharmacy in the universe for you is in your body already. But it all starts from your thoughts. And if your thoughts are that are in conflict, that are, you know, regardless of what we're taking as far as food, our food is going to impact us differently based on our perception. And we know this. The data has affirmed this. And I could share, I'm not going to share it now, but if you want to, I could share even a milkshake study that was done by Alia Crum and her team, seeing how our thoughts impact how food affects our bodies.
Well, so let me understand this a little further, and I might be interested in that milkshake study, since I used to like milkshakes. Now I don't drink them at all. But I could see, like, for instance, in competitive situations, it's very easy to slip into negative thoughts. And also, just about aging, I never thought of myself that I was getting older. And then suddenly confronted with my own data on what was happening to me, my conclusion was, oh my gosh, I'm getting older. Like, these are the effects of age. Like, I saw how I was playing. And even during a game or any kind of competitive situation, it's very easy to slip into negative thoughts like, oh, I'm a loser. I did this. I knew not to do that, but I still did it, and blah, blah, blah. And it reminds me of that Bible passage. I think it's in Job, perhaps, where they say, you know, take your thoughts into captivity. Like, you have to really constantly be on top of what you're thinking, but that's very hard. I mean, it's kind of a meditation that you have to be on top of it, but realistically, it's very difficult.
Yeah. I mean, we're not really taught this stuff. That's the thing. We're kind of thrust into our environment. We're thrust into this world and all of its complexity, especially the last couple of decades. There's so much to distract us from that internal work. You know, there was a time, even you and I, when we were kids, like, we had time to be bored. Like,
yeah.
Being bored is on the endangered species list, straight up. You know, just having just time to just, like, be in an elevator or, you know, stand in line somewhere. Everybody is on their phone. We're constantly externally focused, and we're not taking time to process data, to think about our thinking. So much of our thinking isn't even our thinking. It's just regurgitation of the stuff that we're taking in from all these different effective devices, you know, whether it's television programming or whether it's, you know, social media and all those different inputs. We're not really getting time to think about our thinking and how we are perceiving the world, how we're perceiving ourselves, and to say, oh, you know what? I don't want to think that way. I don't want to think that way about myself. I want to think like this. I want to be like this, you know? So that's one of the big things today. It's like another huge curveball. And we're living at a time of great paradox where we have all of this apparent innovation and technology advances on the surface. And yet, according to the data, We are the most chronically diseased and sick society in the history of humanity. The CDC's numbers from last year, they just published a new report stating that 60% of American adults have at least one chronic disease now. At least one.
Could it be because we're living longer, though?
And that oftentimes, I remember that that was my thing, you know, about 10 years ago, until I came upon the actual data, which is that was a true trend in recent decades. Like, you know, our life expectancy kept rising until somewhere in the 90s, that trend has now reversed, but the rest of society has not got the memo yet. Our most recent generation is the first generation that's not going to outlive our predecessors, their predecessors. That trend of our life expanding has now reversed, which again, it's a paradox that should not happen. All that right. we know, but that's leading to, again, with that paradox, there's a disconnect. We have all this apparent innovation and data, but we are lost as far as understanding what's happening in our own bodies and our own minds.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Before we get to the cookbook and the food aspect of this, just from what you've said, like about the placebo effect and the brain being kind of almost like the chemist on this chemistry set inside of us in terms of our neurons and hormones and so on. What can I do just with that information?
Awesome. All right. And by the way, matter of fact, you want to do the milkshake study really quickly first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Vanilla milkshakes.
So Alia Crum and her team blended up a big batch of milkshakes And this was at Yale, all right? And all the milkshakes were equal in their calorie content, all right? So they're the same size, same amount, and they were all essentially 380 calories. But what they did was they placed different labels on the milkshakes. Some of the labels said 140 calorie, quote, sensible shake, while others are labeled with 620 calorie, quote, indulgent shakes. All right. Again, they're all 380 calories, but they put different labels on them. So people came by, you know, different participants, they enjoyed milkshakes, and they actually tracked their biometrics after consuming the milkshakes and looked at, did their belief about what they were consuming affect how their body processed what they consumed? And here's what was crazy. The people that consumed what they believed to be a 620 calorie, quote, indulgent milkshake, their levels of the hunger hormone ghrelin that drives us to eat more dropped three times lower than what would have happened had they actually consumed the 620 calorie milkshake. All right. So their ghrelin levels dropped three times lower. Okay.
So they were told they were taking the 620, but they were taking a 380.
Right. Okay. So let me clarify this. So yeah, their ghrelin levels had dropped as if they had consumed three times more calories than they actually had. So this is going off of the 380 calories. So it dropped three times lower than those calories that they actually had. All right. Okay. Now, the people who consumed what they believed to be a 140 calorie, quote, sensible shake, their ghrelin levels didn't budge at all. They didn't drop at all. All right. So what that means is they're going to be hungry again shortly thereafter because they felt like, as far as the hormones, these are two glorified hunger hormones. Leptin is the satiety hormone and ghrelin is kind of the captain of the team of hunger hormones, but there's many more.
The brain is telling itself that they hardly consumed anything. This was like nothing. It was like just a piece of
candy. Exactly. And also if they consumed, you know, this 300 calorie milkshake, but they believed they consumed something that was more dense in calories, their body adjusted accordingly based on their beliefs as if they had something that was very indulgent, which helped to quench their appetite substantially. So this is really looking at far-reaching aspects of the placebo effect, right? It's not just about a drug treatment. This is also about how our metabolism is working and how our bodies interact with foods. And this is just one example of many.
So yeah, so how can I make use of this though? Like, because I can't hypnotize myself into thinking, you know, I don't know, you have to be really disciplined on your thinking somehow.
And here's the key. This is the key to all of this is we still are in the driver's seat. And so it's subtle things that we can do in this context. Because for example, like this whole thing of being sensible versus indulgent, we can perceive our food differently. If we're eating something that we think is exceedingly healthy and we don't like eating healthy or haven't been eating healthy, but we believe that it's healthy, we're going to tell ourselves that this is restrictive, that this is sensible, and our bodies are going to approach that food accordingly. Versus if we're telling ourselves, and we don't have to lie to ourselves. This is where I come in with the Eat Smarter Family Cookbook as well to make it more congruent. But like, oh my God, this food that sidebar is healthy is so indulgent. This is so delicious. You know, I'm loving this experience. You're telling yourself, you're feeding yourself, creating this feedback to where like, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe I get to have this. So there's this whole, and I'm not a big fan of this sentiment of faking it till you make it. I believe that if it's congruent, it's going to be more effective. But some people do use that. They do use the whole thing of like fake it till you make it, be it till you see it, but and how they're talking to themselves. But what if we can couple that together with something that does truly have that flavor experience, for example, of being something that's indulgent, right? But at the same time, we're also giving ourselves that positive, affirmative information or language along with it. Now we've got a recipe that can really be effective.
Yeah. So basically, it's funny because I see how you're structuring this cookbook. You give all these cultural and societal reasons like, you know, eat with your family, turn off the phones. This is the benefits of cooking your own meals as opposed to ordering out. So you give like all these stories and examples and the research of kind of the healthy aspects of the environment you set up for yourself to eat. And then you give all these healthy recipes and because they both work hand in hand.
Exactly. So it's layered. You know, we've got the kind of education empowering, but also, and you know this, people learn differently. You know, different people learn different ways. And so speaking to people at different levels, like we have an emoji culture, for example, you know, and like a chain of emojis can communicate a lot for certain people. And so even if you don't want to learn the science, I'm providing, okay, here are the studies affirming how, for example, dark cherries have these anthocyanins that have been found to potentially target fat cells in humans and shrink fat cells. They also are one of the most dense naturally occurring sources of melatonin, right? So now we've got, okay, some metabolic benefit. We've got a sleep-related benefit. So you'll see a sleep emoji when I talk about this food, and you'll see a little muscle emoji denoting that this is good for your metabolic health, right? And so you could just see those things and be like, oh, it's good for this and good for this. For people that I don't want to dig too deep into the weeds on the science, and now I can look at the associated recipe. Like, for example, one of them is these cherry frozen yogurt pops that kids absolutely love. This, again, it's a family-geared cookbook. It's not just for us as adults to have this deliciousness, but also for kids. But now it's a huge upgrade because it's one of my favorite things growing up was like when the ice cream man, I don't know if James, you know about the ice cream man.
Oh, yeah, sure. Genre. Yeah, with the music.
Yes, the music.
All the kids would run. You'd have to like find your mom, get money, and run as fast as you can to catch the ice cream truck.
Bop-bop man's coming! You know, yes, we're all flipping out, you know, running after this guy. But it's like the Pied Piper, all right? He's just so crazy. But, you know, tuning into those things, those cultural loves that we have and not villainizing them, but let's upgrade these things. Let's have these flavor experiences, these cultural experiences, but not hurt ourselves in the process, right? And, you know, just to even transition now to the cognitive piece, and, you know, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, and this is going to shift over to like, what are some of the practical things to do to really optimize or improve your cognitive function. First piece is, again, we can throw all the nutrients necessary, all the, you know, whatever, exercise, what, it's not going to matter if the language is such that, oh man, I'm falling off here big time. You know, there's people out here kicking my ass because I'm old. And I'm not saying that you said that, but we've got to stand guard.
No, I said it.
We've got to stand guard to the door of our mind and those ideas.
Here's the funny thing too. Like, so I live in Georgia right now, and I'm the Georgia senior chess champion, meaning for anybody over age 50, I'm the champion. But so like, it's like, I have no problems when I'm playing someone my age, I'm still playing better than ever, but it's somehow I talk myself into it. I even get nervous when I'm playing someone younger, like a kid.
Ooh. Okay. So this is good stuff. My youngest son, we were just talking before we got started. He plays AAU basketball here in Los Angeles. And it's like a big deal here. It's very intensive. You know, parents are very invested in this stuff. And this past practice, this was the first time that his coach had him, who's with the kids who are 11 and 12 years old. Now he had my son come over and play with the people who are 14 and 15. All right. And he's the only young kid that he had come over and play with these older kids. And my son, right, on the surface, but now he's playing at a different level. There's a different speed. And so I'm seeing my son. I know my son very well in his personality. He wants to be good immediately. If he's not good at something immediately, he gets deflated pretty quickly. And so because he has a tendency to be good at stuff, but also we've had to cultivate more of that like stick to it attitude, right? And so he came out, a couple of things are going well. Got a couple of rebounds. He stole the ball. He had a good look at the basket, good shot. But also these kids were scoring on him, which is he's not really used to. Spin moves, and the ball's moving really quickly, and they're getting up and down the court. There's like a different speed. And for me, from the outside, and the other dads are there watching too, and they're just like, oh man, Braden's really like, he's contributing, right? And we're all impressed with this, but afterwards, Braden didn't want to talk to me until like before bed, which I know his personality, we didn't talk about it. And he came over to me, he's like, Dad, I'm sorry I didn't talk to you. I just felt like, you know, I didn't really do very well. I'm like, bro, You just came over and played with these older kids. It's a different speed, but your coach is doing this on purpose because he knows that that's going to elevate your game, right? You getting
this
exposure.
But could it hurt his confidence so that he starts that negative self-talk?
That's where coaching, that's where support comes in at, because this can be a minefield walking around in your own mind. And so it's through being able to reframe it properly, right? And so, and this is the key, and this is where I found that sticky point for him, because I saw this, being able to observe. I was like, and so he did that. So when you're playing at this higher level, at this higher speed with these guys, now when you play kids your age, it's going to seem like you are completely at a different level than them. And he said these exact words. He said, that's exactly what happened. Because at the end of practice, he went and scrimmaged with his age group again. Mm. And he's like, I felt like they were like little kids, right? That's the language he used.
And for me, it's almost like the reverse, because the younger kids now are like the older yes. kids for him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's what we got to do.
Now that I've been playing like, you know, the whole universe of people, including these really fast moving, like younger kids, when I go back to the older, my age, I win those tournaments, no problem. Or not no problem, but you know, I win them. But I'm so upset when I lose to these younger players now. The players when I was young.
But that's still keeping you better than the people in your age group. That's the thing to focus on. You know, and also of course is as you do it, you know, what's said is that, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together. You know, as you do the process, you know, you said even just it's been pretty recent that you've gotten back into doing this. You haven't even hit your full stride yet. You haven't even locked in at the level that you're going to be at. And so, I don't know
because lately I've been thinking it's almost a race against time. Like the older I get, the faster I start to fall into oblivion.
We've got to absolutely crush that belief. That belief needs to be deleted, put into the trash, and then wiped from your computer completely. It is not serving you whatsoever, and it's not even based on reality. It's not really based on the facts. Let me give you another little insight. That 70-year-old guy that I saw performing yesterday, you know, doing this grand talk, and, you know, his ability to, you know, think on his feet, you know, different stuff was going on. But I'll tell you what, if of everybody that he's texting, I'm probably the person he's texting the most and staying in touch with me. We hang out quite a bit. He's around somebody with a younger energy. I don't think he's doing it consciously, but he's around that vibration. He really loves being around my family and I. You know, his significant other, like in him, they hang out with us quite a bit. He's got these other inputs. He's got an elderly kind of like community as well, but he spends a lot of time with people who are very youthful. You know, and he sees himself in us. He plays, you know, he has this very childlike approach to things. And it's conditions, right? We've got to put ourselves in these different environments that here's a key. It can often feel uncomfortable as well, you know. But for us, especially as we get older, and this is the point I'm trying to get to, it really, really does operate it on a use it or lose it basis, straight up.
Yeah.
Our brains are already about efficiency, and they're not fully, really, quote, fully developed until our mid-20s. And then we start this process of degradation. But even when we're younger, you know, a lot of stuff, if it's your brain is always looking to optimize and to kind of, you know, put on automatic certain processes. And so it's going to clip away things that are unnecessary. You know, those neurons that firing, the synaptic clefts and the axon terminals and all that magic that's happened to create these laying down myelin, all of that stuff is just going to degrade if you're not using it, because your brain is all about efficiency. And so when we're younger, because there's so many inputs and it's so much is trying to grow so quickly, it can seem like you can do more stuff, right? But same thing holds true for kids. And we're seeing this earlier and earlier, by the way, this cognitive degradation. If kids are not able to, you know, be in certain conditions to explore, to play. Play is one of the things that is of everything we've seen in the clinical research. Play dramatically improves, you know, reading ability, math skills, all this stuff is correlated with movement, right? And so here's the pin, you know, kind of cherry on top of this is with this use it or lose it thing, it deeply holds true for the brain. But if you want to look at the brain as a muscle, but also our other muscles as well. One of the hottest things in science right now is looking at the muscle connection to longevity. All right. And a friend of mine just had a book, New York Times bestseller just last week, all about muscle and its connection to our immune function, our cognitive function, and true healthy aging, like longevity. There are people who are in their 80s and 90s who are doing over 100 squats a day because their chair is on the floor, all right? If we're not doing that capacity, do you know how many people, how much a small percentage of people in the United States that can actually sit down on the floor at age 70 and get up off the ground, let alone hundreds of times a day? They do it in those other cultures because they have to. And then you see a documentary on these blue zones and these places where they have all these long-lived people who can do all this stuff. It's because they do the stuff. They never stop doing the stuff.
It's so interesting you say this. So a friend of mine said something similar. He pointed out to me, so I'm gonna shout out to Todd Bryant, who is a chess master, works at chess.com. He pointed out to me the winners of this year's various national senior championships. There's like two or three different tournaments. He showed me photos and they all, as he put it, they all showed significant musculature. Like you could tell they work out, like they lift weights. And you could tell for each winner of these tournaments, he said they're all lifting weights. You could see it. And so he suggested to me, you got to start lifting weights.
All right. So we're getting into it. This is the transition I'm making into the practical. So I'm laying the groundwork to tie in pieces like this. And yes, when we contract our muscles, we release a variety of hormones. And some of the most identified as far as cognitive function, they're called myokines. So they're these different compounds that go directly to the brain. And these can elicit a variety of different effects. So they also have an impact of supporting our immune system as well. But one of the most notable things is keeping our brain young, essentially, you know, but also, you know, improving our cognitive function and reaction time and all these different things that we lose, because even our reaction time and our ability to move is a function of our brain. And all of it's not like some, that's part of the problem with modern science is that we compartmentalize everything, right? We've got this part of the brain does this, this part, this muscle does that. And we forget that it's all connected. That's the problem. You know, the hippocampus is largely identified as the quote memory center of the brain. But memory doesn't just exist in the hippocampus. There are other, your cells, even, you know, downstream, not in your brain, have what is effectively their own memory. You know, we hear this term like quote muscle memory, but we're finding now we've got some data, you know, if you look at Dr. Caroline Leaf and her research, that our mind isn't just located in our brain as well, you know? And so it's like this conversation, we tend to like look at the human body and brain like gears and levers, right? So Descartes, you know, like Descartes and like looking at this mechanistic view of the human body and brain, we're so much more complex than that. And so that is step number one. And just the fact that your friend just mentioned this to you recently as well, this is an affirmative piece here. Once you start strength training on a regular basis, you're going to be a problem for these younger people. You're going to be a problem for them.
And so I've never lifted weights at all in my life. So, or I've lifted weights, but I've never had a regular practice that, let's say, lasted more than a few weeks. And so what I've done after Todd said that to me, I got a bunch of barbells, and I know myself, I'm not going to go to the gym. So I got a bunch of barbells and they're just sitting right here in my office. And occasionally I'll pick them up and do something. You know, I look at some YouTube videos of what exercises work, but I'm probably not doing it enough. I don't know.
When you said that you haven't done this, like this hasn't been a part of your kind of, you know, lifestyle. For me, I got excited because you have so much upside that people don't have that are doing it consistently, even though there's a huge advantage there, of course. But for people that are new, because your genes have been screaming at you for years to just be like,
you don't think they gave up on me?
No, I mean, the blueprints are still there. They're still there, but these epigenetic inputs basically can alter the way that your proteins, like, you know, another one of my mentors, Dr. Bruce Lipton, cell biologist, and somebody who really popularized the term epigenetics, the science of it, getting people interested in it. He's been doing this for decades. And he shared with me that, you know, and when I was in my university biology class, you know, we're taught DNA to RNA to protein, right? We see the outpicturing, the protein copies that are getting printed, right? So what you're seeing when you see me, James, and when I see you are your proteins, predominantly. Of course, we're seeing some minerals in the mix and that kind of stuff, but it's the proteins that are getting printed based on the blueprint, right? But he shared with me that the epigenetics, so inputs from your environment, there's nutrigenomics, where how our food will change how our genes are getting expressed. He shared with me that one gene can have 3,000 different potential proteins that get printed out based on the inputs, all right? Some of those proteins are gonna code for things or express for things that you want. Some of them are gonna be expressing things that you might not want, right? But we label them as diseases. And these are simply adaptations. For the most part, most of us arrive here in life with pretty good genes. You know, less than 0.5% of human beings have true genetic defects that they're born with. A lot of times something happens, certain exposures. You know, we have this whole category of carcinogens, for example. You know, the WHO has this whole list. One of them is just riddled in our food supply right now, glyphosate. The WHO classified it as a group 2A carcinogen, which means that it's probably causing cancer in humans. And the Environmental Working Group did a recent analysis of grain products on U.S. store shelves, and they found that 80 to 90% of conventional grain products are contaminated with glyphosate that probably causes cancer in humans. What do you think's going to happen? You know? And again, that's just one category. We've got this new emerging category that now we've got a pretty solid amount of science on called obesogens. So these are obesity-causing agents that go beyond this kind of rudimentary calories in, calories out metric, looking at humans again as calculators and mechanistically, but altering the way that your metabolism is working, leading to excessive body fat gain, right? And many of these compounds are in our food supply.
What food has obesogens?
Listen, you can be pretty much guaranteed if you're eating Pop-Tarts, if you're eating, you know, Funyuns, you know, any of these ultra-processed foods. And let's clarify what this is, because humans have been processing foods forever, all right? Processing a food is not a problem. When you cook a food, you're processing the food. Taking a tomato and creating pasta sauce is a process. Pressing the oil out of olives is a process. That's minimally processed. When you cook a steak or you cook a sweet potato, you're processing the food. You're changing the way that those, you know, certain bonds, you know, the chemical complexes in the food and how even the bioavailability of the nutrients, a lot is changing when you cook a food. Minimally processed. Humans have been doing that for thousands of years. Ultra processed foods, on the other hand, this new category, it's just been the last few decades. That's when you have a field of wheat, for example. You see that field of wheat, and somehow that becomes a bowl of Frosted Flakes. That field of wheat somehow becomes those Pop-Tarts. And shout out to Jerry Seinfeld's bit on Pop-Tarts. All right, I always think about that.
I'll tell you one quick story. So in 2010, for a few months, I did have a trainer, and I was, it was like three times a week. But I was also addicted to Eggos. And
you're like 11 in Stranger Things. Have you watched Stranger Things?
Yeah. Yeah, that 11's the...
She's got like those
powers.
Yeah, the powers. Yeah. She loves Eggos.
Go ahead. I watched the first season. But he could tell by looking at me whether I had Eggos or not that morning. And he was 100% correct.
Wow. You had the Eggo, so, the Eggo effect. Yeah.
Yeah, I must have been like exuding obesogens.
And it's not just the fact that it's been so denatured, it's all of the things that have to be added into that process of getting that field of wheat into that Pop-Tart form. all of these synthetic, newly invented chemicals, additives, mm-hmm. preservatives, you know, many of these things, again, unfortunately, they're largely unregulated because of this GRAS system, or generally regarded as safe, where we have this loophole from decades ago that all of these compounds are able to just be put into our food supply. It's like, oh, well, this we found 40 years ago, this wasn't a problem for humans in such and such amount, right? It's just like, it's ridiculous. And so, you know, with that being said, by the way, just to put an affirmative piece on this, this study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2018. And they were looking at like, what are the underlying causes of our epidemics of chronic diseases that we're seeing today? Heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, list goes on and on. Poor diet was the number one cause affirmed in this huge meta-analysis of our epidemics of chronic diseases. Poor diet, namely ultra-processed foods.
Human nature can get a little messy, but nature is powerful enough to save us from ourselves. Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent lifts away tough stains with a 97% bio-based formula. For when you think whipping up yellow curry chicken in white pants is a great idea, totally not speaking from experience. Let nature do its thing, so you can feel confident doing yours. That's the power of Seventh Generation. Find Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent in fresh lavender and other scents at SeventhGeneration.com.
So let me ask you, when you were diagnosed with your degenerative disease when you were 22 years old, like, again, your first reaction was depression, but then how did you get control in your mind even, and then in your body of this disease? And then obviously, I'm assuming the conclusion is that you defeated it because you're looking good and healthy, and it doesn't seem like you have this disease.
I'm not exaggerating when I say this. My diet was about 90% ultra-processed foods at the time. Living in Ferguson, Missouri, surrounded by fast food, surrounded by ultra-processed foods at every turn, liquor stores lined with ultra-processed foods. That's all that I knew. I grew up eating like that. And if anybody thinks that I'm exaggerating, listen to this. This was published by the BMJ, British Medical Journal. This is like top tier peer-reviewed journal. They found recently that 60% of the average American's diet, ultra processed foods, and I'm specifically speaking about American adults, 60% of our diet as grown-ups is ultra processed foods in the United States. But the situation is far worse for children. And the Eat Smarter Family Cookbook is actually the first book is publishing this data, this new study. And I'm grateful for that. But also, this is like, don't just hear this, like, we have to change this. They looked at the consumption of ultra-processed foods by U.S. children for 20 years. This was published in JAMA as well, the Journal of the American Medical Association. So in 1999, the average child in the United States diet was 61% ultra-processed food. By 2018, that number was almost 70% of our children's diet is fake food. And with these studies, when I say these numbers, there's always people, there's always kids on the higher end and on the lower end. There are some kids out there that eat 20% ultra-processed foods. I was at the other end eating 90% ultra-processed foods. You know, a typical day for me would be McDonald's breakfast, you know, sausage biscuit, you know, with egg and cheese, or hotcakes and sausage. And for lunch, it would be like some chicken tenders, which is a little bit of like real food in there somewhere. And, you know, some chips or some fries or pizza. And then for dinner, I might have a family can of like SpaghettiOs or a box of Velveeta shells and cheese if I had a couple extra dollars, or go to Jack in the Box, get four tacos for like $4. I'm sorry, not $4, $2 and some change, because they're 2 for 99 cents. All right. That's how I'm eating every day, every single day. It was cheap, it was accessible, and it tasted really good. And it was making my tissues out of really low quality materials. That's at the core of this, and why this matters is we're literally making our brain cells and every cell of our bodies out of the inputs that we give it. And we're not taught this in school. I had a high level nutritional science class, biology class in a university, we're not taught when we're studying the cell and looking at the mitochondria that the mitochondria is made from your menu, that your nucleus of your cells are made from the nutrients you eat. We're not taught that. There's a disconnect. And so when I became aware of that, thankfully, it took 2 years before I did anything because I was given permission and told that I was unhelpable and I was miserable, you know, but I had some seeds planted. This is why this matters too. You know, thankfully, like some people saw something in me, you know, my grandmother, like just, it really kind of came up after a couple of years of suffering. Like, you know, she always thought that I was going to do well. She was always checking in on me, even though it was annoying, but just like my life conditions are not matching up to my blueprint of what I set out for my life to be. And I've been blaming everybody else. And sure enough, yes, the environment was not conducive to my wellness at all. But I've been pointing fingers like, why won't this doctor help me? Why won't this person help me? Why won't these people support me? And I had to have the audacity to take responsibility and say, you know what? I'm going to do whatever I can do to feel better. And really, that's when everything changed.
How did you change the habit? I mean, there's not only the knowledge that you had to have, but then how did you change the habit? Like, I'm talking now back, I did a podcast with Rich Roll back in 2015, and he was telling me when he made his big switch in diet, he was telling me part of the problem was, which made it like agony for the first couple of weeks or months or whatever, was that the food you eat creates the bacteria that lives in your gut. And that bacteria has cravings. It wants that food more. So if you're just eating junk food, for instance, the junk food bacteria is hanging out in your gut brain and in the serotonin in your gut and saying, give me more of that junk food, or it triggers really real pain in the brain.
Yeah, it's they're very addictive. And we know this, you know, based on there's certain phenomena called post-ingestive feedback of where certain flavors are attached to certain nutrients that have been manipulated by food scientists. You know, there's vanishing caloric density where, you know, we eat something that's very calorie dense, but then it disintegrates so quickly. Like your brain is kind of tricked. Like, I think I just ate 100 calories or something, but doesn't seem like there's much there, you know? There's all these different phenomena that are created via ultra processed food. And yes, it can be difficult, but here's the thing at the end of the day. And, you know, Rich experienced this as well. There is something remarkable about us that gets muted because we can truly, like, that's nothing to us. Some fucking food? Like, we can overcome that. Like, that's no, it's we're so much more powerful than any of these things. And I'm saying that because so many people have overcome the most trying and tragic conditions of inputs. You can name everything. Whatever you name, whatever addiction, whatever poor circumstance, somebody has risen from that stuff. And they've lived to tell the tale.
That's a good point.
You know, we are so much stronger and more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. But this goes back to what we started with today, James, which is we are living in this environment today where we're constantly inundated with information. There's so much to be into. We're regurgitating stuff, but we're not able to actually go within and to access, to analyze, to perspective take, to question our thinking, to self-assess. And as the great statement says, to know thyself. We have a society today that is distracting us from any of that stuff. So it's so easy to say this is too hard, even though it's hard, but it right. doesn't have to be worse than it is. And so we throw in the towel before we even get started a lot of times.
I mean, when you were first changing your habits, like I imagine you had to see results fairly quickly to continue with it or else you would give up because you just didn't know.
And this leads to the power of, yes, you just mentioned something so important in this whole process, which your brain needs feedback. This is the power of doing something that is actually effective. All right. When I first decided to feel better, to get well, and my goal was, it started off with asking a different question. There's this interesting thing that the brain does. It's called instinctive elaboration. All right. And we all have a dominant question. Basically, the human brain is always, you're always asking questions. A lot of times it's unconscious that's fueling your focus. All right. And you know Jim Quick, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so my guy Jim Quick shared with me, when I shared with him this about instinctive elaboration, he was like, you know what? I had this experience with Will Smith. And by the way, this is before all the stuff, yeah. All right? But he went to on set with Will Smith where he was filming Suicide Squad. And he got to ask Will some questions and to see, like, how is he thinking? And so Will's dominant question, and this is what Jim calls it. So I mentioned that this is called instinctive elaboration, right? We're all always doing this. And Jim was like, we all have a dominant question. And Will's dominant question was, how can I make this moment magical? Because on the set, they were cold. They were like up in somewhere in Canada, it was snowing. Will was like making hot chocolate for everybody, telling jokes, and just had the staff and all the, you know, the co-workers. Everybody was feeling like such a connection and like a magical moment. And so Jim was trying to tweak and find out how he can even help Will to have an even more powerful dominant question. And so what they came to was, how can I make this moment more magical, right? To already have the assumption that this is a magical moment and make it more magical. And so my dominant question prior to making this transformation was, why me? Why me? And so internally and externally, I'm going to be looking for things to affirm why my life sucks, why I'm unhelpable, why I'm in so much pain, why nobody will help me. I was just affirming all that stuff every day. And so I made this switch cognitively, and I didn't know any of this stuff at the time. But when I decided to get well that night, you know, I was about to take my pills to try to knock me out to get some sleep because I was in pain. And I was thinking about my grandma, and I was thinking about this third doctor I'd just seen who told me that he can't help me. And I was just like, okay, what can I do to feel better? What can I do? But I said it like this, what can I do? What can I do to feel better? Instead of trying to get all these people to help me to feel better, what can I do? And being a logical thinker, again, it's not like, again, the genie pops out of a lamp or whatever. Shout out to Will Smith in Aladdin or whatever. But I put a plan together and I was like, okay, I need to lose weight. Because at this point I'd gained a bunch of weight because I was so sedentary and in so much pain. I was like, just logically thinking, what if I get some of the pressure off of my spine now that I'm so heavy? And what if I just walk a little bit, like do a little bit of exercise to help to lose this weight? So that was my goal. My low-hanging fruit, being an athlete at a high level until I started having all these injuries, was working out. Like I knew a thing or 20 about that. And so, but the whole food piece of losing weight, this is what I did first, James. I did SlimFast. All right. Have a shake for breakfast, one for lunch, and a sensible dinner. I was going off marketing because I watched so much TV. I saw it. First of all, the shit was nasty. Second of all, I did initially lose like 2 pounds like that first week, but it was miserable. It was miserable. I was always hungry and it was like, it was nasty. Like it wasn't enjoyable. And about a week later, a friend of mine that I had known for a couple of years, she, and, you know, usually we would like kick it, like hang out, do different stuff. But for whatever reason, she was driving and I was just in the car with her and she went to Wild Oats, which has since been bought up by Whole Foods. It's kind of like more like a mom and pop type of Whole Foods vibe. And I walk into this place. I live in Ferguson, Missouri. I'd never seen anything like this. There are all of these like, you know, organic foods and all these like aisles of supplements and books and all this stuff. But because my mindset was different, that I'd driven past Wild Oats on the highway, you know, hundreds of times. I didn't know that place existed. But I was tuned into the why me, my life is terrible station. And so I couldn't see it, but it landed me there and I found a book there. And I actually have that book over on my shelf in my library, right next door to my office where we're at right now. And I went and looked up my condition, degenerative disc disease. And there were these studies. And again, like I was in college. I was like, oh, is there actual references for this? Like this is, and I go and look at these studies and one of the studies found that when you are deficient in calcium, funny enough, your body will, because calcium is needed to not just for your bones, it's needed to clot your blood. It's kind of important. If you don't have enough calcium, your body will literally leach the calcium from your spine and from your hips, in particular, to help aid in other processes. Guess what else I did? I broke my hip. a couple years earlier at track practice just running. And it's just like, does this book know me? Has it been watching me? Am I in the Truman Show? That's how I felt at the time. Like, this literally happened to me, but I'm drinking milk every day. The marketing says, got milk, strong bones. My bone density was so low, it was that of somebody, again, who is in their elderly years, but in our population of unhealthy folks. 80, 90, the doctor specifically said 80-year-old when talking about me.
Gosh.
All right. And so here's the last piece. So I found out this information, and here, the first thing that I did was, okay, I need these supplements, right? I need this supplement. Another study was omega-3s and how important that was for bone density. I was like, I had no idea. I didn't know. First of all, I'd never heard of omega-3s. And once I start to get some of the data on this, I'm like, oh, this is all about the brain. But no, no, no. You need omega-3s for your bones as well. And I was just looking at my nutritional intake, and I'm like, I probably don't get any like viable source of omega-3s like at all, like in a maybe once a year, maybe. And so the first thing I did was become a natural pill popper. All right. So now I'm just replacing my prescription drugs for all these supplements, which was not doable on my college poor guy living in Ferguson, Missouri budget, but also that wasn't the most bioavailable. Thankfully, I came across some data. And by the way, a lot of these studies that I'm sharing are in the Eat Smarter Family Cookbook. And so bioavailability means, can your cells actually use it? And I shared a study actually on vitamin E coming from a synthetic version of vitamin E versus a food-based version of vitamin E being twice as bioavailable and usable by the body. And so what I ultimately did was this. I identified these different nutrients to help to regenerate my tissues that I was not getting in my diet. If you're not giving your body the raw materials to make your tissues, it's going to do a patchwork job. So I started to eat all these foods that have these compounds. And within 6 weeks, this is results not typical, by the way. So I was close to 200 pounds. You know, I'd lost about 16 pounds in that 6 weeks. And the pain that I'd been experiencing for 2 years was gone. And let me share this with you, James. I don't usually talk about this. I was terrified. I was terrified. Every step that I took, every time I stood up, I was afraid that it would come back. And so I had to relearn how to be pain-free. And eventually, it was 9 months later when I got a scan done, and my two herniated discs had retracted and they were in place. And now the light was shining through my discs again, where there was black wow. because of the degeneration. And at 30, my spine was younger than my chronological age. That's not supposed wow. to be possible. But this is what we're talking about with whether it's our brain cells and our cognitive function, whether it's our physical body. Not only can we slow down the degradation process, but there is some potential, according to peer-reviewed data and my life experience, to even reverse it.
So let me ask you this. Like, you mentioned about supplements versus the bioavailability in food. Like, what is the, like, I for instance, take vitamin D supplements every morning, and I don't know what the measurements mean. I take like 10,000 IU versus of vitamin D3. I don't even know what any of those yeah. letters mean or numbers, but I didn't, I think it helped me through COVID, and I don't really get colds a lot, and so on. So it seems like it works a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of vitamin D3 supplements are coming from like natural sources. They're coming from, a lot of times people don't realize this, but sheep, coming from sheep's wool. All right. So it's really fascinating that, you know, it's kind of that closer proximity to something natural. There are some vegan versions of it that come from, you know, certain forms of, you know, mushrooms and things like that. But we've got to keep in mind that our ancestors were eating food to be able to get these nutrients. And so we want to go food first and also allow supplements to be supplemental in that. Because in particular, during COVID, for example, there are, and I'm not exaggerating, there are dozens. There's over 30 studies, including randomized placebo-controlled studies looking at vitamin D dramatically reducing the incidence of severity of symptoms, hospitalizations. The data exists, and there's a ton. It's ridiculous how many studies. And I'm not saying that because I want it to be true. It's just what is. I I wouldn't have cared if it was any different, but that's what the data says. And so with that being said, there are spot things for us to supplement, but let's look at what have our genes expected us to do the longest. And for many of us, it's going to be, not for many of us, for all of us, but we got to adjust our conditions today, but we make vitamin D through sun exposure. It actually, you know, those rays interact with cholesterol in our bodies and convert through a process that's remarkable. Your kidneys are involved. Your liver is involved. There's all these processes to make natural vitamin D that is, again, made for your receptor sites because it's made in you, by you. So you can't overdose, underdose. Like, your body knows what to do if we're getting that sun exposure. But guess what? The sun is our enemy now as well. You know, the sun is trying to kill you. And it's so crazy. Like, we go to these extremes and we don't question and just stop and think, like, wait a minute. Is life on planet Earth possible because of that flaming ball of goodness? Or is it just like straight up trying to murder us?
Yeah, like, why do you think the authorities, is it just happens to be random? Or why do you think the authorities basically try to say, don't go outside, don't, you know, eat according to this food pyramid, which means 8 servings of pasta a day. And, you know, why do they screw us all up like that?
We want to crack this open. I mean, all right, let me share this. Let me start with this. And, you know, I work to always be a person who is thinking in terms of being balanced in my perspective. And so whenever, and this is something I would encourage other people to do, but it's very hard. But if you have a piece of data affirming something you believe, I challenge you, and I often do this, I'll go and look at something that a published, you know, piece of data that's done well that denies what I believe to be true by this paper over here. Because this is the thing about today. There is something to affirm everything right now, all right? And so the truth is usually somewhere in the middle. The problem is when we get to these extremes and we think that, you know, this is all wrong and this is all right. And so with all that being said, just looking at logic here, and I'm a big fan of looking at results. Here in the United States, just from last year, we had $4.2 trillion invested in healthcare. $4.2 trillion. Far more than any modern industrialized nation. Far more. We're like in a different stratosphere. And yet we have bottom tier results. We have bottom of all these other modern societies, we're at the bottom, all right? Or near the bottom. But yet we spend so much. And so again, there's a paradox. There's a mismatch here. Something's not adding up. And so what I'm pointing to this to say is that, why is this like this? Well, unfortunately, if you're going to bet on something to invest in the United States right now, that's going to definitely return you money in a very volatile time, bet on sickness, bet on disease of people. It is one of the most lucrative things that you can get involved in. And pharmaceutical companies are just, I mean, they're crushing it. And again, this could be from the perspective of trying to help people, right? And there are many people being in this field for 21 years and being open. And actually, I've been at, like, when I'm talking about this stuff, I've been in these different situations, you know, and having this outreach and conversations, you know, with pharmaceutical companies. You know, I'm in all these really unique places, whether I'm like doing a guest lecture at the neuroscience department at NYU, or like I'm working at, you know, Google. Like, I've been in all these different places, and I could see, like, there's a lot of good people trying to do good and help people. And we have a system that values above all returning those profits to the shareholders, shareholder value. It is a business first. And why would they be in the business of people not having diseases to treat? That is stupid. It's plumb dumb, right? And not, matter of fact, and by the way, we don't want to just cure something. We don't want to have a one-time customer. That is stupid. Having repeat customers, having people on a lot of stuff, this revolving door of medication. And a lot of times, a lot of these apparent new innovations in drugs, And this is just how it is. A lot of these things have this apparent innovation, but most of them are not better than what's already on the market. It's just a reframing of things so that they can not go into, you know, where things can be put into a generic versions and lose out on money, you know? And so there's not a big vested interest in having a healthy population that would be, at this point, suicide for our economy, because we have an economy right now that is dependent on illness.
It's like they create sickness in order for, you know, the economy to benefit through the pharma. They create war so we could sell tons of, you know, what is it? It's like every soldier is like $17,000 a month to equip with military equipment. And so somebody makes every dollar of that. And so I, you know, again, I'm not, everybody knows I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but it is what it is. Like somebody makes money on all these things.
That's
and
it.
Whether it's intentional or not, we don't know. But like you said, there's, if nobody was sick, the pharma industry would go bankrupt.
Yeah.
So you got to start to wonder. And you mentioned something earlier, this is ultimately related, but you mentioned the dark cherries. And what did you say? First of all, I've never heard of dark cherries. I don't know why I've never eaten them. But what did you say they had in them?
Anthocyanins is one of the compounds. Yeah, and they've been found, I shared the study in the book, that they've been found to actually target fat cells and could potentially shrink fat cells.
And so in this book, you have lots of instances like that where you're identifying these foods and what, it's almost like this supplement does this, but with these foods, there's tons of different supplements inside each food. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different things these foods do. And then you weave it together into recipes.
Yeah.
And what I like in the book too, it's not just the recipes. It's like, this is why it's important to cook them with your family. This is why it's important to socialize while you're eating, you know, with your family and friends and neighbors and so on. I'll tell you, I think in the past 20 years, I've upgraded my diet. Like I don't eat fast food at all. I don't eat three meals a day. I probably eat like 1.5 to 2 meals a day. You know, just, I don't know why, but I never cook. I order out almost every night and we eat dinner as a family watching TV. So that's our routine. And probably that has to change at some point. Like there's all these habits that have to change and it's very difficult to do that. Like I get excited thinking about it, but then I run out of steam after a little while. Cause I got to start slowly with these things somehow, but I love the recipes. Like I've tried some of these recipes and they taste really good.
Yeah. That's the magic too. You know, I'm a big fan of food. You know, growing up in the culture that I grew up in, flavor is huge. You know, it's such a huge aspect of food and enjoyment. And working as a nutritionist for so many years, I would unfortunately, you know, kind of take stuff away from people that they liked and replace it with things of less value. And so quickly, fortunately, I learned that that wasn't the way to go about things because people want change, but they don't want to change that much to get the change. And so I started finding a soft place for people to land. And to really work on how can we upgrade what they're doing using real food? And so like with your goal, for example, with cognitive function, we do know a ton of specific nutrients. I mentioned those omega-3s earlier, for example. So we've got a couple of studies and some of them are in the book as well on omega-3 supplementation, improving recall, improving reaction time. And one of the studies that I noted was actually using MRIs or fMRIs and looking at the human brain, they found that people who are consuming less than 4 grams of EPA and DHA, specifically, these are animal-based omega-3s a day, have the highest rate of brain shrinkage. They're losing their gray matter, all right? And gray matter matters.
Wow. So I eat a lot of salmon, for instance, and that's filled with omega-3s, right?
Right. And here's the thing, though. With that being said, we've all had a nice grilled salmon. You know, that's nice, but that might not do it for everybody to be consistent. And by the way, one of the studies that I noted in the book is published in the journal Neurology. They found that people who eat just one seafood meal per week do in fact perform better on cognitive skills tests than people who don't eat at least one seafood meal per week. So we take that delicious salmon, which we, in about an 8-ounce serving, you can get 5 grams of your omega-3s.
Let me ask you this, Sean. I eat salmon almost every day.
That's the problem. So, okay. No, I mean, that's not the problem. Let me rephrase this. So that exactly leads to it. Like, okay, For somebody like yourself, I don't know if are you comfortable eating the same thing over and over again?
Yeah.
I think you are. Yeah. That is your personality type. Like if this thing works, I just keep doing it. You know, like
right. You
were doing stand up 6 nights a week. Like that's
right.
You're different.
I like doing the same thing every day.
You're different, right? Where some other people, they might be like, okay, this grilled salmon is a wrap. Let's create this into some interesting ways. And one of my favorite recipes you mentioned in the book is the salmon burgers. That recipe is out of this world delicious. And you're getting all of those nutrient inputs from that salmon and also other complementary foods that support cognitive health as well. And so that's really the target is like, you know, let's create some diversity here. But even with that, specifically with salmon, okay, what are some other food sources that we can get these omega-3s, DHA and EPA? Also, I mean, there's a ton of other different types of fatty fish, by the way, you know, mackerel, you know, sardines and stuff like that. There's so many different types from small fish to big fish, but salmon has really gotten all the shine and rightfully so. Here's why salmon is so remarkable is that it has astaxanthin. Not to be mistaken with the anthocyanins earlier, but astaxanthin is this kind of like red pigment, that's how you can identify it, that protects the omega-3s from degradation, even when cooking. That's why salmon has that little extra magic with it. But egg yolks, you can find a really good source of omega-3s. You can find this in grass-fed beef as well. You know, there's many other foods, but seafood really is top tier when it comes to getting those omega-3s in.
Yeah, so I feel like I've got that covered. usually when I eat salmon, I eat it raw because I'll have sushi or something like that. Mm-hmm. So
yep.
I'm not
now.
Even...
Here's the other thing. This is for you. And this is what I want to get to today as well, because the omega-3s might not be the issue, but it's also the processing and your cells being able to communicate with each other. Something called signal transduction. Omega-3s are critical in that because they're made into structural fats in the brain. But the magic doesn't happen without very specific minerals, all right? Namely, electrolytes. So these are minerals that carry an electric charge. And researchers at McGill University found, for example, that sodium functions as a, quote, on-off switch for certain neurotransmitters in the brain that, for your cognitive function, but also protect your brain against neurodegenerative diseases and degradation. And so if you're not getting ample, and this is here's where the issue happens, because we hear sodium, we're like, well, salt. Like, I thought we were supposed to watch your salt. I'm not talking about sodium, salt, that's one kind of salt, by the way. We call, you know, table salt, sodium salt, but it's also chloride. There's a combination of sodium and chloride. There's multiple forms of sodium. There's multiple forms of magnesium, multiple forms of potassium, all these key electrolytes. Calcium, what I was deficient in, it's not just one. There are multiple forms of all of these things. This is why food is so special, because it has a diversity. But if I'm taking a supplement to try to get my, you know, fill in the blank, am I getting the right form of it that my body is screaming for to run these processes? So with that being said, one of the things that I might even have you supplement, so I want you to target more electrolyte-rich foods for sure, which generally going to be, you know, fruits in particular have a really great source of electrolytes. But I would actually...
Yeah, I don't have a lot of fruit.
Yeah. All right. I knew. All right.
I got to get on that.
Some diversity of fruits, but also I would probably even jump in here and recommend an electrolyte supplement for you, but one that is giving you the electrolytes and not unnecessary sugar, which this is the last piece of this that I want to share. It's not just about adding in the things. It's about avoiding the things that create the damage, right? So here's the thing. The human brain is about 2% of our body's mass, but it can consume about 25% of our calories. And researchers at Harvard found that your brain will gladly sop up 50% of the glucose from any meal that you eat. It is a very glucose-driven, hungry organ through our evolution, but we never came across a lot of sugar at one time. Not very often. In our society today, it's every day, all day. But our brains have not changed. They're still going to be sucking up all that. And so now we have this epidemic of what's been labeled type 3 diabetes, aka Alzheimer's disease. where we have insulin resistance taking place in the brain.
Yeah, I've read some stuff about that Alzheimer's is like linked to diabetes now.
Yes. So avoiding obnoxious amounts of ultra-processed sugar, adding in key electrolytes, and a great electrolyte supplement for you, I think would be pretty freaking potent. And I'm going to send you a link for one after we wrap up.
Oh, that'd be great.
And also, you know, nutrient-dense foods that also contain naturally occurring electrolytes. But we want to avoid Gatorade, Powerade, all that crap that I grew up.
See, that's what I've been doing. I've been buying, like, on the day of a tournament, I'll get Powerade because I thought that would keep the electrolytes going, you know, throughout the day. Like, it doesn't work. I totally run out of steam in the late afternoon. Like, I start to run, I just completely start collapse.
Are you getting the sweetened ones?
It's blue.
I got the blue flavor.
So it's gotta be sweet.
Yes. So, yeah. The sugar is going to have a counter effect, especially in your energy. Mm. You know, it's just inherent because, again, you're going to get this glucose spike. Your brain is going to fast metabolize that stuff and you're going to crash. And you're going to condition your brain cells to want that or to need that until we, you know, kind of work out of it. And so, but also the dyes, like how's that blue? You know, like some of these food dyes have been targeted, peer-reviewed data, creating cognitive dysfunction, you know, leading to ADHD and all these different things. Adult ADHD has skyrocketed. That's one of the main things I was seeing when I was working as a nutritionist was adults coming in who've been diagnosed with adult ADHD, you know, and again, a lot of these things that we're doing just haphazardly trying to do the right thing are causing problems.
So what are some other electrolyte foods?
Yeah, like I said, anything that's going to be rich in, you know, sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium. So just to throw out a few of these, I really like magnesium might be the most, it's kind of like picking your favorite kid. I don't want to do that. But because it runs so much, we've identified over 650 biochemical processes that require magnesium in order for them to happen. So that means like there's 650 things your body can't do or can't do properly without magnesium being involved. Like, it's crazy. As a matter of fact, ATP, what everybody has heard at this point, and even in my college classes, this is the energy currency of the body. No. That's potential energy. ATP has to be binded with magnesium in order to be like active. Like, it's really that important. And for magnesium, for people just to target, anything that's green is going to be a good indicator that's going to be a nice source of magnesium. Not always.
Avocado?
Avocado is a decent source of magnesium, absolutely. You know, green leafy vegetables as well. But funny enough, chocolate is also a really great source of magnesium. But even when we say this, I'm not talking about Three Musketeers and whatever the nougat is. I'm talking about like high quality dark chocolate and or just getting like cacao nibs, like the real like chocolate bean nibs and like adding that to your smoothies and stuff like that. So that's one specific electrolyte is a couple of food sources, but you know, we could do this all day. You know, we have this natural tendency, like even when you go to a restaurant to like do lime or lemon, that kind of stuff, there's electrolytes in there and they make the water more hydrating essentially because water doesn't it doesn't just go into our cells when we drink it. There are these protein bridges called aquaporins that really they respond or they require like a certain structure of the water. It's kind of like I think a helpful analogy would be like a when you have like that express pass for tolls, you know, just being able to pass through the tolls without slowing down or like that ease of access is helpful when the water is structured. And when I say structured, what that means is minerals. Like when people talk about like alkaline water, what makes it alkaline? It's the mineral content of the water. There are certain minerals that are alkaline. There are certain minerals that are more acidic. That's what this really boils down to. So hydrating your cells itself, adding a little lemon or lime or whatever. There's all these kind of fruit infusions you could do, berries, but all of that stuff really helps to make the water more hydrating.
I did not know that. That's very interesting. I always wondered why people want lime with their water.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to start having that more.
Yeah. And I added in the book too, there's a spa water as well because again, it's just a more hydrating form of water.
So Sean, I really want to say again, these recipes, first off, this book is really like well done. The photos of the dishes are beautiful. The quality of the paper, or the quality of the book is really high. All the information you put in here about the foods, about the meals, about the diets, about exercise, about everything is just so valuable. But I'm not a natural sort of cook at all. I don't cook, but everything that I've done so far has been like easy to make and really delicious. Like, this is the only cookbook I could ever say I've really made recipes out of. So otherwise I've thought up stuff and put stuff together, but this has been a really great experience just going through and the cookbook and learning from it. I highly recommend it. But also this discussion, you really like opened my eyes to a lot of things. My only fear is that I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to like do all of this and then not do it.
Yeah.
So I got to figure out how to like, I don't know. I just got to figure out like what to do first. I mean, I've been doing these in bits and pieces. Yeah. And like I said, I've been trying to lift weights but it's like sporadic. It's hard for me to get into a habit.
Yeah. Your superpower though is like when you get locked into something, you're superhuman at that thing. And so I think it's just trying to find the leverage point with the strength training, whether that is like having a trainer that you actually like, you know, maybe they're funny or maybe they're completely, you know, I don't know, just a complete moron. And you could like, I don't know, finding somebody that is your accountability source as well might be helpful for you because, yeah. And also even maybe learning the language of strength training because it's a whole science, but we tend to see it as this like, gym bro, like whatever, that type of thing. But there's like this intense, beautiful science. And maybe when you start to learn about like your muscle fiber types and like how this thing could do that thing, and you start to like paint a picture and make it more artistic, like it's just finding that psychological leverage for yourself. But yeah.
You know what really helped me actually was, so my stepson was going through some stuff and he started lifting weights every day or like, 4 times a week, something like that. And not only did he get confident as he saw his body transform, and it really did start to transform, but just in general, I just saw his mood improve, his everything improved, like his life changed. And now he's like, now he's into it. Now he's an addict of weightlifting. Not in a bad way, but he just does it. He goes to the gym and does it.
Yeah, you've got more.
And he goes with his friends.
Firsthand anecdotal data right there.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really interesting. He inspired me to you know, that's when I also started looking into it more and getting the weights and so on as I saw the transformation it had on him. But I'm excited to keep going with the food stuff. I take tons of supplements, but I'm hearing what you're saying about supplements, and it does make sense that it would be more impactful to do this the natural way. And plus I love the food. So there's a lot of good things going on here. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. It was great to begin to catch up. We got a lot more catching up to do, but I just want to say the title of the book again. I'll do an intro also that'll say it in the beginning. But The Eat Smarter Family Cookbook by Sean Stevenson, author of Eat Smarter, which goes into a lot more of the science and stuff like that about the food. So people should get both. But The Eat Smarter Family Cookbook, 100 delicious recipes to transform your health, fitness, and connection. Plus, the Model Health Podcast, could find everywhere you get podcasts. I highly recommend. And Sean, once again, it's so great to talk. I can't believe it's been 6 years because COVID interrupted us. We always used to do this in person.
Yeah, it's bananas. Like, it's just been like a time vacuum. But like you said, we got a lot of catching up to do, and today was fun. So thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Human nature can get a little messy, but nature is powerful enough to save us from ourselves. Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent lifts away tough stains with a 97% bio-based formula. For when you think whipping up yellow curry chicken in white pants is a great idea, totally not speaking from experience. Let nature do its thing so you can feel confident doing yours. That's the power of Seventh Generation. Find Seventh Generation laundry detergent in fresh lavender and other scents at seventhgeneration.com.